Sorry, virtual audience. If you missed all that, you didn't actually miss anything. I was just blabbing on. So let's start over again. Hi, Claudia.
Hi.
Use your microphone.
I should use the microphone. Yes.
Right.
Hi.
And yours has a green light. So
yes.
All yes, right. Mine's on.
You're smarter than I am for sure. All right. So tell us how you arrived from the world of young adult and fantasy and Star Wars and all these other great projects to Jane Austen world.
All right. I'd been a Jane Austen fan for a long time. I had read them when I was younger, like in high school, and I wasn't really quite old enough to really sink into them yet. And then when I was a young adult, then came the year 1995, which was the annus mirabilis of Austen adaptations. We got three of the greats. The Pride and Prejudice with Colin Firth, The Persuasion with Kieran Hines and Amanda Root, and the wonderful Ang Lee Sense and Sensibility with Emma Thompson. And between these things, I picked them up and began to read and reread and reread. And it began many, many years of reading them repeatedly every year. There was a period of time when I had a smartphone, but you didn't have all the apps you have now. The only six books I had on my phone were her six published novels. And I'd read one, and when I finished one, I'd pick up the other and read that. And that went on for about 3 years, I think. Anyway, so I was a big fan. But I would say somewhere between 10 and 15 years ago, P.D. James, Children of Men, one of my favorite books ever. I got really excited. She wrote Death Comes to Pemberley. And I was just like, yes, somebody's going to kill Mr. Wickham. Everybody has a motive. Everybody. They all want him dead. It's going to be so great. And then the book came and I read it. And it's a very good book in many, many respects. But spoilers for this book that's been out for more than a decade, the murder victim is not Mr. Wickham. And I could not get over it. The person they killed was like, nobody cares who killed them. Wickham! Wickham! And I've since learned, and I really think this is a valuable thing that this taught me, you know, if those of us who get really passionate and enthusiastic about our movies and TV shows and books, we know what it's like to have the creator make a choice that we're like, I just can't understand why you do that. But I've learned that sometimes, you know, I mean, sometimes it's just wrong. Netflix Persuasion, anyone? But sometimes there's nothing wrong with that original choice, but your creative self is knocking. It's like, you didn't want to see that. You want to do that. And over time, it became evident to me, like, yeah, that would be fun to do. But my career was so different than this. Like, for a long time, I thought I might just do it as fan fiction. I had the idea, but I kept talking about it. And I kept talking about it and thinking about it while writing other things. And then finally, I guess it was about 4 years ago, I was describing it to somebody and they said, oh yeah, that one. I'd told them before. And I was like, you got to start it now. You're never going to do it. And so I started it then. And The Murder of Mr. Wickham came out of that. And I would actually really like to thank P.D. James, not only for that bit of inspiration, but also one of the many really great things in Death Comes to Pemberley is very, very thorough legal and forensic information about that age and time, which I definitely benefited from.
Well, that was her expertise,
yes,
as you know.
Yes.
Actually, do you all know that Dalgliesh is having a second season? I watched the first episodes last night. And it's really interesting because for those who don't know, he was the chief main character in most of the P.D. James crime novels. They have gone to extraordinary lengths to make it look like the 1950s. In fact, I thought that they'd resurrected it for a brief moment. But anyway, I had wondered when I read Death Comes to Pemberley if she didn't want to like touch an Austen character, that it was better to knock off somebody that wasn't actually in the Austen canon.
I mean, he was. He was in the Austen canon, but you know, I don't think he has 20 lines, you know. Whereas I was like, nope, killing him.
Well, no, I think you satisfied. I think you satisfied many readers of Jane Austen who were hoping he, you know, would meet an untimely death. But
yeah, I've had multiple booksellers say there are people who just look at the title and like,
right,
he's dead. Yes,
right.
We've all needed to see this for a long time.
Well, you and I talked about that last year, actually. And if any of you didn't catch it, we did a Zoom event for The Murder of Mr. Wickham, which you can find in our YouTube and Facebook stuff. So it's already there. But anyway, yeah, no, a tribute indeed to P.D. James. Tell me for a brief moment, digressing here because it's keep coming up, what do you think of as fan fiction?
I mean, fan fiction, wow, I can really go on this, so I'm going to try and keep it.
This
edited.
Is part of the whole AI discussion,
it
so
is.
I'm diverting slightly into it here because it's so interesting.
Fan fiction, at its core, is fiction written with existing characters and for the material that is still under copyright protection in some way without any tie to that. You know, you're not beholden to stay with that canon. You can change anything. Somebody who I thought really understood fan fiction said, the really fun, cute little romantic comedy shows where everybody runs a coffee shop, they get fan fiction written where everybody's in this terrible zombie dystopia fighting to survive. And all the things that are about people in a terrible zombies, like dystopia trying to survive, people write fan fiction where they all own a coffee shop and it's all really cute and great. But then you have things that are written just like an episode or continuations or undo something you didn't want to happen in canon. A friend of mine called that faux fiction. But
right.
But yeah, you're inspired by other people's characters. And I also very firmly believe that fan fiction is the core storytelling impulse. Because if you think about it, there's reasons that the ancient myths don't go only one way. Somebody wanted to hear more stories about Odysseus, and somebody made some up. You know, there's a reason that there's so many versions of the Arthurian myths. Somebody's like, well, let me tell you about this knight. Or, actually, you don't know this about Guinevere and Lancelot, but, you know, somebody came up with this.
The once and future king stole my heart.
I love that, too.
Right.
What Shakespeare only has one totally original story for all of his plays. And the whole idea, like, no, you're supposed to think up every single element of it from scratch. That's the only thing that's creative. That is a very, very new idea. You know, so fan fiction is the stuff that gets written just because you have to know what else happened with the story or what else happened with the characters. It's out of this very pure thing, or read often for the same reason.
Wow, that's inspiring. But from a tiresome legal standpoint, which is what I was going to bring up here, you know, are you allowed to profit from fan fiction?
You can't. And wow, you're also going to wish you hadn't asked this. You probably out there are familiar with the website An Archive of Our Own. It is not only the world's biggest fan fiction website, it is one of the top five websites in the world by volume of visitors.
Really?
Yes. And I actually know some of the people that had that idea and set that up. And part of that it's under the umbrella of something called the Organization for Transformational Works. And this includes legal professors, academics who study fan fiction, etc. And there's a very firm set of rules that you sort of have to follow. But as long as you aren't making money from it, and there's no danger of confusion, nobody thinks the thing where, you know, everybody from The Walking Dead actually owns a coffee shop is like, oh, this must be really what's happening. You know, nobody confuses that. As long as those two things aren't present and you're not making any money at all, they argue that it is transformative work and therefore fair use. And could that get challenged in court? It could. But back in the 90s, a few companies tried to push back on fan fiction. But I think they began to realize this actually cultivates fans, it deepens their connection to what we produce. And I think now it is tacitly allowed and these companies are happy to say, like, yes, it's transformative use, because that way they are not obliged to go after it all the time to protect their copyright.
This is where AI may alter the whole ball game, but we'll see. I brought that up in part because the Jane Austen copyright ran out a long time ago, which is one reason we have The Murder of Mr. Wickham. Mm-hmm. Right. Did any of that come up at all for you? Did you hear from any of the Austen people at all?
Who are they?
Well, I don't know.
At this point,
I mean, you know, I think the whole thing.
No, I mean, her work has been public domain for forever. I mean, right. Jane Austen has been a vampire before, you know. She was actually going around. She owned a bookstore and she was going around killing other writers who wrote sequels. So I'm just, I consider myself warned.
Right.
You know, there have been Bollywood movies that have been Pride and Prejudice. Bridget Jones's Diary, Clueless. This is not the biggest deviation from the canon that has existed.
I wasn't actually thinking about that so much. Is there are Jane Austen societies and all the rest of it. Are they happy to see more and more versions of, you know?
I mean, I think there are purists, of course, and which is fine and good and cool. But I have to say, my local chapter of the Jane Austen Society of North America has been tremendously supportive and great. And for the most part, I mean, I assume the people that hate it just aren't emailing me, but I've gotten a lot of email from people that, you know, readers have responded, I really hear the characters. This is them. I recognize them. And that's what you want to hear.
Yay. Well, I agree. All right. So let's come back to the characters. Who did you decide you were going to populate your series with?
Well, I always joke that the first book, The Murder of Mr. Wickham, was the cousin of Avengers Infinity War. Let's just get everybody together once. You can't do it every time, but you can do it once. And so we had a country house party. And originally my thought was that it would be at Netherfield, that Bingley had taken it again to be near the Bennets, you know, so Jane could be near her parents as they grew older, and it would be there. But then you ran into too many people just from Pride and Prejudice who would hate Mr. Wickham. I was like, okay, they've got to be somewhere else. Who is the likeliest to throw a great big house party she didn't quite mean to throw? And I think that brings us straight to Emma immediately. So I put little connections that I thought were at least credible between the characters. A little in-joke to me, my favorite versions of Mansfield Park and Emma both have the male lead being played by Johnny Lee Miller. So I made those characters cousins who bear a resemblance to each other. But I couldn't really find a way to get Catherine Tilney that mad at Mr. Wickham. And also, I knew that for it to feel like a Jane Austen story, you need, with the exception of persuasion, but even that pulls back to this, you need young people forming an attachment. You have to have that. And I was like, okay, I already knew that I was going to spread these books out across the Regency period for when they would have taken place so that I got to catch up with the characters where I thought would be most interesting to catch up with them. And I was like, okay, that already gives me, you know, the young adult son of Darcy and Elizabeth. I'm going to have the daughter of Catherine and Henry Tilney, and they become the sleuths. And that pushes us forward. And then in the latest book, The Late Mrs. Willoughby, this series will continue, I can say. But every future book will take place primarily in the world of one of the novels, not bringing everybody together. And obviously, this takes place in the world of Sense and Sensibility in the village of Barton, where Mrs. Willoughby drinks the wrong glass of port.
What was she doing drinking port anyway?
It was a whole thing. Man, some of the rabbit holes you go down, like when did women drink port? How much port did they drink? Right. Historical sources do not always agree on these things. You would think reality, so easy to get the canon right? No.
Yeah. I know. Women traditionally drank sherry and the men gathered for port or stayed in the dining room for port while the women adjourned for tea and port, genteel and so forth. But why not port?
Why not?
Why not?
Well, now we know why not.
Right. Yeah. So I've noticed that the series is actually now titled after Mr. Darcy and Miss Tilney. So you've locked yourself into them as being your not only sleuths, but they have a tentative relationship. But Mr. Darcy has his own set of issues to deal with. So I find that fascinating. Why did you decide to create, this is the younger Mr. Darcy, not the older Mr. Darcy. Why did you decide to make him neurodivergent?
I actually began without that in my head at all. My first thought was just, Jonathan is more Darcy than Darcy. I wanted him to be somebody that his father would be like, could you relax? You know, who is this guy? And when I'd written the first few chapters, I was going back by, because you can have this idea in your head, but at a certain point you have to say why. And as I reread it, I realized that if I were coming to this as a reader, you know, with no preconceived ideas, I would read this character as neurodivergent. And that was really interesting to think about, because on the one hand, they would not have that frame of reference at all. There would be very little understanding of exactly what sort of set him off or why he found certain things difficult. Most people would assume that the things he did that weren't like things other people did were him being willfully obstinate or difficult, when that isn't the case at all. And that would be very hard. But on the other hand, not every neurodivergent person, but a fair number of them really like to have rules and routines that are concrete and clear that you can get to. And I was like, routine? This guy knows how virtually every day of his life is going to go. If he goes to a dance, he knows exactly when he will be touched and, you know, by whom for how long. He has these things. And this is a society that has tons of rules, some unspoken, which he can stumble over, but it has many that are explicit. And, you know, when we read and write period fiction, there's such a tendency, it's almost universal, for us to gravitate to the character who's a little bit more modern in their opinions. We, you know, they don't believe in that silly thing we don't believe in anymore. You know, we always are drawn to that. And sometimes there are reasons for that, because you need that person to give you a window into the other mindset. But I thought, you know, Juliet Tilney sort of is that character in this series, but it's good to have another character who actually really loves those rules and loves those routines, because they help him navigate the world. And I thought, that is a really interesting window to explore in a Regency setting. And I've actually heard from more than one reader, people saying, it makes me wonder whether the older Mr. Darcy might not have been a little bit on the spectrum himself. And I was like, you know, I don't know, but I can see that read. I can.
Really interesting point. I just thought he was typical of, you know, his age and class. And as you say, it was very conventional. There were, yeah.
But even the men
structure.
And, you know, people in his age and class were like, you know, Darcy, you're Bingley's like, I would not be as fastidious as you for a kingdom. You know, like, relax.
Good point.
And if a guy with a starched, like, cravat is telling you to relax, you really should relax.
You know, that's a good, I mean, I often wonder, given the clothing of the time, how people did relax, you know. Men in particular, women could don what they called tea gowns, or, you know, maybe that was Victorian, now that I think about it. Tea gowns. I think that was a way out of, you know, stays and all the rest of it.
That, and even though Regency women wore corsets and stays, they were much less restrictive and hard than the ones before and the ones after. And a lot of those dresses were not as uncomfortable to wear as a whole lot of the fashions that came before.
A lot of them were like nightgowns. I mean, if you really look at
muslin is very soft and comfortable. And
I think they were a reaction in part to the 18th century, you know, the really elaborate, I mean, no wonder people had people to help them get dressed, because, you know, you couldn't possibly get in and out of, you know, Marie Antoinette kind of clothing by yourself. There isn't a chance that you could do that. In the same way, I've often wondered how the men, if they had to be shrugged into their coats and their valets had to insert them, how they ever, like, fought a duel or, you know.
That's what your second is for. And,
well, no. I guess they must have taken them off for a lot of the things that they did, because if you were really in a coat that tight, there wouldn't be a lot of movement.
I saw a really great I don't even know what this was. It was a special on British TV, and I found it somewhere in the depths of Amazon Prime. One of those things you only find when you're really procrastinating. But they had decided to throw a Regency dance and go through everything with all these people. And they were students from the Royal Academy of Dance, learning the steps and going through these things and coming up with the outfits that would have been worn and lighting the room with candles. Like, they were trying to do absolutely everything the way it would have been done. And they realized in short order, like, women got there and changed shoes. You could not walk through winter weather, and this was done during the winter, as many balls and dances were then. You couldn't do it in the slippers that they wore to dance in. Right. They're like, no, everybody went and changed their shoes, which seems so weird to us, but it's not really weird.
I think they probably had to wear Wellingtons, you know, to walk across. I mean, think about it. Go back to Pride and Prejudice with Jane and Elizabeth, you know, walking back and forth a distance of like 2 or 3 miles in the country where...
Mud.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So I'm not surprised. There's a very strange little Regency book coming out in June called An Agreeable Murder. Have you run into it?
No, but I covet the title.
Well, I haven't decided. I think it's totally satirical. And much of it is wrong. But at the same time, since you bring it up, one of the sensible things they do, they are all converging on a what turns out to be rotting country home, but they are indeed going to like a mudroom, and they're spending time in an actual wash. You know, I mean, that stuff, sanitary arrangements are really brushed over a great deal in Regency fiction.
Yeah, that was something that had to decide, like, how much of this am I going to get into? You
right.
want to dip in a little bit, but at the same time, I'm not doing something like, you know, the incredible book Longbourn that came out a few years ago, which is the story from the point of view of the servants, which is, you know, very, very different. I really enjoyed it as a read, but the tone is totally different. And so that's not what I wanted to do. The mystery makes it different enough already. Those of you who have read the first one know that a broken chamber pot plays a pretty critical role in a key scene in this. You get some things as well in the late Mrs. Willoughby because, you know, poisoning, it's kind of a grisly death. And you watch the scene go from the very polite Regency party to, okay, something's going on that we're not acknowledging, something's going on that we have to acknowledge, until it's just become something that is off.
Bodily functions were not supposed to be on display at all. So, you know, this poor woman is vomiting from the poison and all the rest of it.
Yeah, everybody's just like, what do you do? This happened, of course, obviously. Not this specific thing, but people vomited, people fell down, things happened. Like, how did they deal with it? It's fun to wonder.
It is. So, Emma, indeed, I loved, you just mentioned the name and I've now forgotten it, the Emma...
Clueless?
Clueless, thank you. I remember going to see Clueless, and I was clueless, and after a while, I began to recognize the stories. I was watching the movie.
To be as dramatically altered as it is, it's a remarkably faithful adaptation in terms of story beats. It's right on.
So how much of Emma did you decide to insert into the late Mrs. Willoughby, or did you decide?
Oh, no, Emma. No. It's just the world of Sense and Sensibility in this one. I miss her.
Oh, sorry.
That's okay.
You're right. It is Sense and Sensibility.
No, and that let me catch up with people like Eleanor and Edward, who were the couple from Sense and Sensibility that didn't make it to Emma's party, or Willoughby himself, obviously, and my favorite, Mrs. Jennings, because, wow. If you need information carried to any character from any character, Mrs. Jennings could hear it and she will deliver it as fast as she can. And you don't appreciate that until you're writing. You're like, oh, it's so great. She could be anywhere with any information at all. And it's totally in character for her to do that. Yes.
So how are you handling the sleuthing? I mean, to what degree are they visibly sleuthing, you know, without transgressing any social mores?
Yeah, that's one of the big questions, both for me as a writer and for them as investigators. They have to couch some of their questions and inquiries in things that would be considered socially appropriate. They're still finding out how to do this, of course, in the first and even to some extent in the second book. I'm editing the third now. They're beginning to get, they've got their feet under them at this point, but they're still working that out. And it's difficult because there are things they can't straightforwardly say that they need to discover. But I believe, I think it's in The Late Mrs. Willoughby, at one point Juliet says, you know, it is regrettable that being unladylike is so exciting.
Love that. So if you were doing an Agatha Christie country house murder, you could ring in actual policemen, but that is not an option this early. So how are you handling that part?
Different ways for different things. I think of this as Jane Austen meets Agatha Christie. You know, you have like the Jane Austen sort of lightness of language, but some Agatha Christie events and consequences. In the first book, there is a magistrate. Frank Churchill has gotten to this position because really it was just a socially prominent man. This was not necessarily anybody who had any particular expertise in this matter. And so it's become Frank. And he means well, but I think we all know from Emma that Frank is not a details guy. He just isn't. And so he's sort of willing to go along with the common prejudice that, oh, well, of course, it's, you know, a servant or a vagrant that did this.
I mean, the very opposite of the butler did it.
Right. And they know that that's probably unjust, and so they want to move against this. Now, in The Late Mrs. Willoughby, the county is very temporarily without a magistrate. He has passed away. The new one has not been named. And when the new one is named, he has to come into town, which puts a bit of a ticking clock on the sleuths. But for the time being, there are just two constables who are well out of their depth. They want a magistrate before they're going to take the biggest steps that they're going to take. And that only gives them so long to work so that they can get to this answer.
So are you thinking of involving the Bow Street Runners at any point? Because they were actually the only sort of real police force operating.
Not at this point. I will say, no, I'm not going to say anything about the third book. It's okay. Different in the third book. That's all I can give you. I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. I think the Bow Street Runners were basically London-centric, mm-hmm. so I don't know that they penetrated out into the country.
We have not yet gotten to London in this series. Right. I very much hope that we will, but we haven't yet.
You're going to actually tackle Pemberley, which is probably the house of all these characters that readers are the most familiar with?
I would love to write this series for a long time. I can say there are going to be at least four books. I don't believe I'm getting to Pemberley in those, but I would love to get there. But I want to get to all of them eventually, if I can.
Right. When they did Mansfield, did any of you see the movie of Mansfield Park? Because the house, if you remember, had a huge... Well, this is the older movie. I mean, I probably saw it in the 90s or something.
Nobody's really nailed Mansfield Park yet. The revisionist one came really close. Has everybody seen that revisionist one that's in
the
room?
When did it come out?
I think late 90s.
Well, that must be the one I saw, and the house is a huge role.
It is, yeah. Right. But anyway, it was so interesting, and it was very revisionist, but in a way that I thought was fair and shed some interesting light on the characters. But then instead of having the character be Fanny Price, who is this incredibly timid, shy, pious, sort of frail girl, they just switch and put in a Jane Austen double. And it's just like, this doesn't work anymore. You know, having her make all these, you know, little acerbic asides and then putting her in a story where she's afraid of speaking up. And it just didn't work at all. And you know what drives me crazy about that version? They were this close. The aspiring writer and the person making the snarky observations should have been Mary Crawford. If you had that as Mary Crawford's take on Mansfield Park, I think that movie would be perfect. I'm sorry, that is a real deep cut. We're going to get back to the series now. Sorry. I have feelings.
Well, it's just, you know, if we're familiar, I mean, it's hard to read Persuasion without seeing Lyme. You know, I mean, the harbor and the whole bit is so important. I actually went down there just, you know, for that very purpose. So if you're going to write about an iconic place, you know, which if you're going to do the iconic places in the books,
I mean, sadly, there is no real Pemberley.
No, I know.
You know, but
you're okay there, but it's iconic to readers.
But yeah, I have gotten to go to Bath now, which is great. So we got to get them to Bath again. You know, like I said, I hope they'll go to London, and I have been to London a few times, but oh no, I might need to research some more.
Oh no.
You know, and I certainly come up with ideas of the houses, though it's really hard, honestly, to wrap your head around a house as big as Pemberley must be.
Absolutely true. I mean, you know, they were sheep visited around a lot. She mm-hmm. had family that had some wealth, mm-hmm. hence, you know, and the Godmersham thing was part of it. She had two brothers who were admirals who mm-hmm. did really well, but they were in that kind of weird, they weren't really upper class, the Austens. They were genteel, but not middle class. The father was a rector, right? Mm-hmm. So she would have had familiarity with some of the great houses.
Yes, and also, I mean, and this is so useful for these books. I mean, nothing happens in all of these books except, you know, a young woman meets some people and they're like, we have dined with you three times. Come live with us this winter. We will buy you clothes. I mean, and off they go, because back then visits, one, were a significant source of entertainment and enjoyment, getting to hear somebody else's stories and getting to tell those. And, you know, maybe they play the piano or the harp better. You know, like that was a very meaningful thing to do. And also, that was a society where getting young people married was everybody's job. Pretty much everybody was supposed to be taking right. part in this. And inviting young men and young women to stay somewhere was increasing their sphere of acquaintance and therefore increasing their chances of an advantageous match.
Now we sort of do that with wedding parties, you know, where, I mean, that's kind of a modern version of it in some respects. There are a lot of books where people meet at, or movies or whatever, where people meet at weddings. And that's
Man,
kind
none of that.
That
had anything to do with my bridesmaid experience at all.
Oh, okay.
No.
Well, I was interested. Jonathan, who does not want to go to this house party, it's a month.
This is in the second book, not the first house party. Second house party.
The one we're talking about, yes. Right? The death of Mrs. Willoughby. He doesn't want to go. His parents encourage him to go, and it's for a month. I mean, if you don't want to go somewhere to contemplate a whole month, so he's actually hoping he can work out an escape after, to be polite, a week or two.
Yeah, he's figured that slightly over 2 weeks could be considered about a month. We've all done that math in our heads at some point. Like, sure, you could round up to a month from there. Yeah.
It's a little difficult to imagine a life where you can seriously think about just taking a month, you know, as a visit, and that people would have the resources. It took a lot of money to have a house party. Mm-hmm. You were going to be feeding all these people. You had to have servants. You had all the rest of it. So, you know, it was not a lower class occupation.
No.
Right. All right. What else would you like to say about the late Mrs. Willoughby?
Oh, gosh. Have any particular questions, start thinking of those now so we don't have that moment in just a few minutes where I'm like, any questions? And it's dead silent.
No, we're bringing in a ringer from the front desk. Because
oh, fantastic.
John, it's your turn. Right. We have our person who is actually passionate about all of this as
okay,
well.
Okay, so, all right.
And he always has great questions.
Okay.
So, are you prepared or are we going to wing it here?
Well, I love both books.
Oh, good, because otherwise this was going to get awkward in a hurry.
It would. But if I understand correctly, you talked about fan fiction, but that actually prompted you to start writing. Is that correct?
Well, I mean, you mean writing at all?
Yes.
Yes, I got into writing through fan fiction.
Particular fan fiction did you start with?
The X-Files. It was obvious that Mulder and Scully should kiss. I mean, yes. Yes, everybody knows this. And they kept on not doing that. And, you know, something had to give. And this was also just as mass use of the internet began. You know, I got on like AOL in 1994 with a disc that promised me 10 free hours and a 2400 baud modem.
Wow.
You know, so Woo! But, you know, and I dove in, and at first it was all very, very bad. I was just flailing along. But we were reading, writing, whatever. You were just so excited, and it was still a very new thing. And then I wrote one story. It still wasn't very good, but there was a scene in it. I'm not going to get into detail because I don't want any of y'all Googling this, where the feedback changed. Before, it had always been like, I love Mulder and Scully, you know, or something like this. And people were like, oh, my, that reminds me of when I did X, or something like this happened, et cetera. And I was like, oh, wait, that scene actually resonated. That one, people connected to that. Go that way. And then I proceeded to write fan fiction for so many other things for many years.
You've done a lot of research on the Regency time period. What surprised you the most about it?
Honestly, what surprises me the most is the fact that, as we touched on before, historical sources don't always agree. You think that reality, you know, after writing in Star Wars, where sometimes it's like, okay, we have to sit down right now and figure out how hyperspace works. Mm-hmm. You know, you think like, oh, it's going to be such a relief, you know, but people really violently disagree on things about like what was served at a country house breakfast, or did women occasionally drive this one kind of carriage, or was that only for men? Or, man, do not even get started on whether or not they had scones yet. In certain very small corners of the internet, there is a bloody scone war going on. Do not go there. So yeah, that is what surprised me the most, is that sometimes you still just have to take something that is credible and go with it. Sometimes some things are lost.
But aren't there also historical figures that you don't think existed that really do, that change your perception?
Well, yeah. I've always found it interesting, for instance, like Jane Austen never met Lord Byron, but they knew people in common. You know, try to imagine the person who got to hang out with both of those guys. That's interesting. You know, that fascinated me a lot. And sometimes it's little details that capture your imagination. One thing that gets touched on in The Late Mrs. Willoughby, I knew there was going to be a scene where we had to be in a pantry. And I was like, what would be in a Regency pantry? I happened to be reading this book at the time, and by God, there is a description of everything that would be in a Regency pantry. And I was just like, yes. And then apparently what you would do to keep citrus fruit fresh, you would bury it in fine sand, like a tray of fine sand up to the stem. And if you did that, it would stay fresh for months. Wow. You know, they knew this stuff back then, and a lot of that information's been lost. But I thought that was really interesting. So sometimes it's little details that really grab you.
How do you know when you've achieved the right tone for your book? Because capturing Austen's voice is not easy, but making it accessible and your voice is part of your job.
Right. You know, the whole thing was to, I'm never going to be that witty and brilliant. Nobody is. So we know that. I can't reproduce Austen's voice, but I wanted something that would feel enough like her that it would provide some of that same enjoyment for readers. And that meant things like, you know, in modern fiction, writers are told no head hopping. Every scene is in one person's point of view. You know, back then, the omniscient voice was very common, and you head hopped a bit. And I discovered writing the first one, it's like, oh, that is great for comedy, because you get to play both people's misapprehensions and mistakes and thoughts against each other the whole way through. And I was like, I think we've abandoned this a little bit too cavalierly. But as for when, you just have to get in the flow of it and keep looking at it and keep asking yourself, you know, does this feel right? A lot of times something hits you a little bit wrong and you don't know quite what it is. And I'll think about it for a long time and finally realize that word shouldn't be there. Also, you discover some words weren't yet in the English language. Do you know a really fun word to discover was not in the English language after you've written your first murder mystery? Motivation. No, it was just motive. Motivation had not been coined. And There was a lot of talk about people's motivations in that book that had to come right out. I don't worry too much. Like sometimes I think somebody found one word that the first OED reference was from 1827 and this was in 1820. And I was like, we're not going to worry about 7 years. You know, that's close enough. But you get stuff, some things that are really surprising come along a lot later, or some things don't. Like, at one point, I think I had a character saying something, I guess, and I was like, that's way too recent, isn't it? That's too new. And then I went and looked, and it was like, not only was it Regency, Geoffrey Chaucer has characters going, I guess, you know, that one's pre-modern English. We've had that one with us a while.
Do you have other modern writers that write in Regency times that you find particularly enjoyable?
I do, but I feel weird about saying so because then it becomes a slight on people I don't mention, and I feel like we all want to be sweet with each other at the tea party. I've enjoyed a whole lot.
Would you turn the cameras off? Would you say names?
No, No. There's going to be a live mic somewhere. I know it.
We've lost Barbara. I don't know where she went.
Farewell, Barbara.
Okay.
Yes.
Your upcoming project is Disney related,
mm-hmm.
I mentioned. It's your first book set in New Orleans?
Yes. My next book is The Haunted Mansion, Storm and Shade, which is a young adult novel that involves the Haunted Mansion that is canonically in my city of New Orleans. Somehow I'd managed to live there more than a decade in this incredibly colorful, creative city with stories around every corner. And I'd had ideas that were set there, but none of them quite made it past premise to plot, you know? And so this came along and I got to do that. And then early next year, I will have another Star Wars book, which will be my seventh.
Wow.
Is that right? Oh my gosh. It will be my seventh, and that is part of the High Republic series. And then in about May or June of next year, we don't have a date yet, the third book in the Darcy and Tilney mysteries will be coming out.
You've written Jane Austen kind of spin-offs or world-adjacent stories. There's a lot of pressure on you as a writer to get things right there just from readers and fans. But you also write for Disney and for Star Wars, Lucas. What's that like? Because I'm sure there's rules that you have to follow. And
sure. I mean, I know a lot of them just through having spent my whole life being a huge Star Wars fan. You know, it's just it's so great that like just hundreds of hours of what should have been wasted time were valuable career preparation. Like I was so on it. I had no idea. But there, all that stuff is written down. You can go get things on this. There's a guy named Pablo Hidalgo who knows everything there is to know about Star Wars. And I actually joked that for a future Star Wars thing, I'm going to get a t-shirt made that has in big letters the three words that everybody who has written Star Wars fiction or TV or movies has said, which is Pablo would know. Every single person says it. Pablo would know that. My favorite thing ever was I needed to ask for one of my books. I was dealing with a spaceship and their captain was a Wookiee. And I was like, do Wookiees shed? You know, I sent this off and they came back. They're like, we have to talk about this, you know? And like, I really hope there was a meeting. I hope there was like a meeting. Like, we have to talk about this. For the record, they don't shed any more than humans do, but because they are totally covered with fur, there's naturally a bit more of that lying around. So you now know more about the seat cushions of the Millennium Falcon than you ever wanted to know. Because you know Han's not in there with a dustbuster. He's not.
Right, as a writer, you have these different kinds of projects that are very structured because you have to follow certain guidelines, you have to color within certain lines. Is it kind of like writing sonnets or something where the form is there, but you're allowed to express your freedom in other ways?
Oh, that's a really good way to put it. And I may steal that in the future because most people just look at that as restrictions. And I look at that as more toys in the toy box to play with. You know, when you get another box of Legos, you don't go, oh no, what will I do? You can now do lots of things. You've just been given the raw material. I mean, sometimes you run into stuff, you know, and you, it turns out somebody else had something in a book or a comic or a TV show that's going to come out and you have to backtrack. And of course, that's frustrating. But for the most part, it feels like you get more to work with. I like figuring out, like, oh, okay, you can't do X, Y, or Z, you know, but V is going to be awesome.
Should we take questions from your fans?
Yes, or anybody else who is here. I mean, luckily we live in the age of the internet, so I got to go to the blogs or posts or from a lot of people who are neurodivergent and hear their experiences and even explicitly like what they don't like when it happens in fiction. You know, I did not want to do one of the caricatures that they had had. You know, I've gotten to read some books. And now the name of this book, I've been looking at it, it's like Unmasked, it's like Autism Unmasked or something. Oh, dang it, it's by Devin Price, I think, is the name. I know the first name is Devin. I've read this book many times. This always happens, you know, you try to name the exact book and all of a sudden it's like, I cannot remember the name of a single book I've ever read. But I read that book. I'm currently reading another memoir from an autistic person, because, you know, it isn't one thing where you can go, this is correct. Different people have fall in different places. What is the name of it?
Unmasking Autism.
Unmasking Autism. Okay. You know, and I think the one I'm reading right now is called What I Mean When I Say I'm Autistic. Yeah. You know, so you can't say, like, this is definitely right, this is definitely wrong. But I wanted, again, to find what was credible and what would feel, that there would be moments that would feel true. And we also got a really great authenticity read from someone neurodiverse, an editor, for both books. And she, you know, gave me some really good insight. And I took pretty much every suggestion she had, except there were a couple points where somebody could have responded to Jonathan better. And I was like, okay, I want his parents to have done well. They love him. Elizabeth, at least, is very capable of thinking about things in, you know, in a different frame. But I was like, you have to see some people getting it wrong because they don't have the framework to really work with that. Again, I'm sure there's still some mistakes in there, but for the most part, when I've heard from neurodiverse readers, they've been really happy to see somebody there so in the Regency world that they also love. Yeah. Thank you. Yes. Hugh Grant is really great at the flail. He does it wonderfully. Well, you know, I mean, that would be how it would have been read at any point before about, 1960? You know, and again, there are ways in which it's not every single moment, every single reaction is governed by that. You know, there are ways in which he responds as others would. It's not some huge all-encompassing difference of everything. But I did want that to be there. But again, since it's not that frame of reference, you can read the book and have him be British if that works, I guess. That was my thought, but the writer tells half of the story and the reader brings the other half.
Other questions?
Yeah. I'm going to return to the fray. If there are any, stay right there. We're good. there's a revival of historical fiction mystery going on at the moment. And genre fiction tends to run generationally. It tends to be popular, and then there's like a 20-year gap while everybody sort of downloads all the ones they've read and then rediscovers them all over again. There's also a Bridgerton effect going on. But I wanted to point out to you, next week we'll be talking to Alison Goodwin, and this is a different Regency novel. Love the hats. I've always wished I could actually wear these hats. This book is spoken for, and we're waiting for a whole bunch more to come in, but I wanted to show it to you. It goes on sale next week. Now, this one, these two actually, are Georgian. These are not Regency, because Regency doesn't actually happen until George III is officially put aside, so to speak, in terms of actual governing by his son and heir, who becomes George IV. And I think that's 1811, if I remember it right.
Yeah.
So the Regency is actually a fairly short period, but we tend to blur it and think of it as the whole Napoleonic War lots of times. But anyway, there are two really wonderful books. One of them, Pandora, one of my favorites, is set in London in 1799. And these are all books where women of interesting characteristics and probably more modern sensibility than, you know, would have been true at the time. This one's kind of like an Elizabeth Peters. It has antiquity and archaeology and a dastardly uncle and all that good stuff. This one, which I really, this is the one I've been telling John about. This one is about a cross-dressing librarian, but she's a cross-dressing librarian out of necessity when her brother, the actual librarian, dies and leaves her completely destitute and about to be homeless because his job comes with a cottage that is part of the job. In England, they call those tied cottages or some similar thing. So she assumes his
identity.
Yep, in order to survive, and it goes from there. It actually is a horrible cover. I can't imagine who did the cover art for this book. But it's a very, it's really a funny book. And I like her a lot. And I'm hoping that the series will continue. But we have a new historical paperback mystery club because a lot of these books, for example, Claudia's books, are being published in these large paperback formats, which I think is great because it makes them, you know, more accessible, less costly. Although God knows the cost of paperbacks has gone up to the cost of hardcovers. When I started the bookstore, $20 was an expensive hardcover. And now $20 is becoming kind of a, you know, ordinary paperback price. But I just wanted you to be alert to that. John, can you hand me under my phone the quiet gentleman? So if you're a Regency reader, once you've gone past Jane Austen, have you read Georgette Hare? Is this?
Yes, although it's been a while.
Right. Well, I can quote entire books of Georgette Hare with absolutely no trouble at all. And you will see over there, which I recommend. But the reason that we're going to give away to some deserving person, The Quiet Gentleman, is one of my favorite stories. In this book, because people used to fight in these books over really absurd things, or they would do things, little power plays. And in this case, when the young Earl comes home, who everybody in his home had hoped he would be killed in the war, but he surprised them and he showed up again. There was a giant silver epergne on the dining room table, which was a very complicated Georgian silver. It had tigers snarling and elephants and, you know, and his stepmother, who hates him, insists that they dine with this epergne on the table. And it's a big power play. And finally, part of the way he declares that he's had it with all this is he has it removed to a side table. It's all terribly polite. And it's one of those kinds of wars. So years ago, when I was doing my National Trust tour and other things of England, I went to a country house in Cornwall, an enormous Georgian mansion, and they had a very sedate tour guide. And when we arrived at the dining room, I suddenly burst into wild laughter, kind of doubled up, and she thought I was crazy. But what was on the table was the epergne, huge silver structure with a tiger actually leaping out of it. So I determined that she was not, nor anyone there, a Georgette Hare reader. But, you know, it's fun that the things that they could use to as power plays mm-hmm. Were by today's standards, so absurd, you know, but they were really important, weren't they?
Yeah, but I mean, a lot of our flexes, I guess you would say now, are, I mean, some of them, let's be frank, look absurd right now, but are going to look absurd going
forward.
Absolutely.
You know, people will look back in 50 years. Well, I'm sure people are going to look back 50 years and wonder what the hell we've been doing for the last several years, but that's a whole different question. It's also good to remember that the Napoleonic War, which is the background for almost all this, was a 20-year war. And nobody knew how it was going to come out until Waterloo in 1815. So the first part of the Regency is, in fact, you know, the end game or approaching end game of the war. But most Regency books don't really recognize the fighting. When did you choose to set your time? So is it post-1815?
This one is 18. They're both 1820. The next one is in 1821.
They really have to be because they're the children
my original,
of the Austin characters.
But I actually really wanted in my first conception of it to have the news of George III's death arrive during the party, that the Regency would be over. And the idea that now you're kind of on unfamiliar terrain. But unfortunately, he died in very, very early in the year, and it was one of the coldest winters England ever had. Nobody was going to any house parties at that time. So I lost that. Probably I could have pulled it back a little bit, but I just kept it as being sort of immediately post-Regency. And for me, at least, there's the idea like, okay, you know what came before. Maybe you don't know what's coming next. Maybe that makes the mystery element read a little more true. I don't know. Maybe.
I don't either. So is anybody new to the store tonight? If y'all been here before, you. All right. This is the easy way that I'm going to pick to give away the book for you. And if you don't like it, pass it on, which is okay. Right. All right. Anybody else have a question? No? Yes? John?
Oh, wait.
Oh, sorry.
I mean, favorite book is actually harder because, you know, I think, you know, favorite character, I mean, I think almost everybody's favorite character is Elizabeth Bennet. She's just too fantastic. And I'm very entertained by Pride and Prejudice, but in a lot of ways, I'm more moved by Persuasion, which really deals with a lot of deeper emotion. If I'm asking which book is most perfectly constructed, I think that's Emma. You know, it's really, really flawlessly carried out. The one that I find I keep going back and worrying with is Mansfield Park, because I kind of feel like, you know, it's the one where she doesn't 100% stick the landing, or rather she basically says in the last page of the book, well, it's up to you to understand how that played out. And how can you stop thinking about it? I can't anyway. And also there are a lot of interesting undercurrents in Mansfield Park that make you wonder if she had lived longer, what directions would her writing have gone in? I mean, you have to read it very carefully, but the signs are there that she's anti-slavery and she's starting to let some characters think about this. That family's money comes from the Caribbean, and it's really the first time that, oh, wait, you know, the origins of some of this money are looked at all. You know, I don't know how far she might have gone down that road or at all, but you wonder about it, which is a really long way of saying I value so much in a lot of the books that I don't know I can say I have one favorite. But, you know, Elizabeth Bennet, I have to say she is a delight to write.
Can I ask one more follow-up?
Sure.
Well, that's that. But so a lot of what we talked about, it's really interesting how much research you had to do with this and how that really must have been a lot. Do the publishers have fact-check? I mean, so like when you give them the book, do they have people who also fact-check, or is that completely on you?
They used to.
They do. It depends, though, like, what are they going to catch? Because it's things like motivation. You know, do you think about that? You know, in my case, somebody caught it. But even somebody who was a very good reader, you know, fact checker, might not have caught that particular one. You know, it's not the stuff you don't know. It's the stuff you think you know that you don't. Like, that's what trips you up. But one reason, actually, that we went with Vintage Knopf for this series was because they do the annotated Jane Austen works, and before they bought the first book, they actually gave it to the person who oversees that, and she caught a couple of little references in there. There are a couple things that actually refer to Jane Austen letters, phrases or observations that I wove in, and she recognized those and was like, okay, all right. Actually, before the first book came out, they gave the whole book to her to read and to an assistant who had never read any Jane Austen at all. They were like, if both of you are happy, then we've got it.
All right. Thank you all very much.
We have one more.
Oh, wait.
I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. I'm blind. I couldn't see
it. Would you advise reading these novels that Jane wrote before reading your works?
Well, I mean, I'm going to advise you to read those novels anyway, because they're great. Yeah. They are well worth revisiting. I can't think of any other work of fiction of similar age that is still readily, like, constantly read purely for enjoyment. And honestly, one of the things that ages the worst tends to be humor, and Jane Austen is still funny as hell. You know, sometimes you go through and you're like, there is a zinger in every single line on this page. And yet somehow she has not paused from telling the story. She has not lost tone. She's just able to slip those things in, you know, just, you know, they call it rapier wit for a reason. You know, you can probably follow without it. And that was our hope. But you're never going to be sorry that you picked up those books. Yeah, and granted, my book will then have to be compared to Jane Austen directly. That's like, oh yes, I would like the Beatles to be my opening act. But
your second book is based on Sense and Sensibility, and
the first book has characters from all six, I'm afraid. So you don't have to read all six, I am sure. But if you read one or two of them, you know, maybe you'll enjoy it even more fully or in a slightly different way. Or maybe you read this first and then you go back and you're like, oh, wait, I see that.
When I think of these titles, I think of high school and summer reading requirements. I went to a private high school, so I felt tortured having to read them. But
yeah, I mean, though, for me, torture was more like Ethan Frome. Has anyone ever had fun reading Ethan Frome? No, but we all have to read. Sorry, that's one of my husband's pet peeves. He's just like, Ethan Frome, why do they do this to children? You know? That's one thing that is fun to do, is sort of go back. Some of that stuff, like Ethan Frome, it still is really pretty joyless, however well constructed. But when you go back to Jane Austen, she's incredibly funny. She's incredibly deft. You know, you even begin to realize, like, there's one or two jokes in there that are a little bit off color. They're very, very carefully done, but, you know, just so that it would be, you know, it could be slipped in, but you're like, wait a second. Hang on there. You do, you do. And a lot of, like, she is so wise about human nature in a way that we connect to. I mean, that's one of the reasons she's still so popular, is we still really understand how our characters feel, what their reactions are, the subtle little underplay of different kinds of conversations. We may be talking about very different things in a very different style, but we recognize that, you know.
You have to give her points, too, because she did all that with elegant language, and there was a lot of formality. You could insult people just by calling them by their, mm-hmm. you know, not, I mean, that comes up a lot, how you address people.
How you address people.
Could actually be an insult.
Yeah, there's one thing where she's talking about a guy named Richard and says something like, he deserved nothing but the abbreviation of his name.
Exactly.
Chew on that for a second. You know, it's like, wait a second, did she? She did.
She did. I assume they still called them Dick, right?
Yes.
Yep.
Yes.
So, I mean, I think you could be insulting in a whole different level when, you know, we were in a more formal society. If you, you know, look at Twitter or some of the stuff that goes by you today.
I mean, the most withering thing in any of her books, I think, it's not something that's said aloud, but Eleanor is having a conversation with the aforementioned Richard Ferrars, who is full of himself and vapid and not very bright, and he's going on. And I think it says something like, Eleanor simply nodded and agreed with all that he said because she did not think he deserved the compliment of rational opposition. I mean, that is just as withering as it gets. And you just keep rolling along in the scene.
It's the standard for you to live up to, right?
Yeah. Or, you know, I'll just be happy if people feel like I recognize these characters, and Jane Austen is not outraged by this.
Not going to rise from her tomb in Winchester Cathedral.
I mean, there is the vampire thing, so
there
can't
is.
Count
That's
it out.
Very true. Well, thank you, virtual audience, for joining us, and thank you all for coming this evening. If you would like Claudia to sign copies of your books, she's probably in a good place to do it, right there on that table. So thank you. Good night,
Thank
everyone.
You guys for coming.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.